Getting ourselves ready for the high holiday season. So I was actually going to kick this off next week when we had a little more time to promote, but I just figured, why wait a week? We'll have a few less people, but we'll be able to start it, actually, God bless you, the beginning of the whole, maybe arguably the holiest month of the year. So what I want to do with you guys tonight and for the next few weeks is focus on an area of Judaism that wasn't always so specifically outlined. And Zuber, we're on?
No, not yet.
Okay, you can put us on. That's cool. welcome. Just so those of you here for the first time, we Facebook Live this. So those who can't make it here physically can watch us. And we're beginning a new series called From Good to Great tonight, and I just mentioned that it's such an appropriate time to do this because it's coming literally on the heels of Rosh Chodesh Elul, the beginning of the month that we work on ourselves and develop our personalities. So I want to start with a story before I get into some sources. And it's not a well-known story, but it's a story about two Jews who passed away on the same day in the town of Brisk. Brisk was in Poland. And it's a true story. In the morning, a poor shoemaker who lived his life in obscurity died, while in the afternoon, a wealthy, prominent, more prominent member of the community passed away. And the community had a little of a dilemma. What happens, God forbid, sorry to start on such a dour note, but what happens, God forbid, if somebody passes away and a person is trying to follow Jewish tradition? What does the family do? What's the first phone call? First phone call really is to the Chevra Kadisha, the burial society, that's supposed to take care of the deceased and treat the body in the most dignified and respectable way according to Jewish tradition. I'm not going to get into what they do, but what happens in a small town, there's one Chevra Kadisha, there's one burial society, there's a group of men that tend to a man who passes away and women who tend to a woman and deal with the body of a woman that has passed away. And the halacha is very clear. Jewish tradition makes pretty clear that one, if you have a situation where two people die in the same community of the same gender and there's only one Chevra Kadisha to attend to the corpse, then how do you figure out who gets taken care of first? The halacha is clear that whoever dies first, because we know that the soul, it's considered a merit for the soul to be taken care of as quickly as possible. In Judaism, we don't really delay much. In fact, when I came back from my trip to Israel, I was on a flight with a very prominent attorney, Ben Brafman, who unfortunately lost his brother. And he was coming back from Israel because his brother was a very prominent rabbinic figure, was buried in Israel. And in Jerusalem, they bury literally on the same day that the person dies. In America, we try to do it within 24 hours or within 48 hours. We do it quickly. And what happened in this situation? The Chevra Kadisha, who had received a handsome son of money from the heirs of the rich man, decided to attend to the burial and to the services of the wealthier person first. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, you've all heard me, at least some of you have heard me quote Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He was part of a great rabbinic dynasty. His father was Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. His grandfather was the great Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the leading rabbinic figure in Eastern Europe at the time, and they called him Rav Chaim of Brisk because he was the head rabbi of Brisk, of this very prominent town of Jews. He sent a message instructing the Chevra Kadisha to desist from their disgraceful behavior, and they refused. And the elderly Rav Chaim took his cane, his walking stick, and he trudged over to the house of the wealthy man, and he chased all of the members of the Chevra Kadisha out until he prevailed and the poor man was buried first. And this is actually a very typical story. A lot of stories attributed to Rav Chaim like this. when he was once asked what the job of a rabbi is, he said, and I quote, "To look out for those who have been abandoned or who are alone, to protect the dignity of the poor and to save the oppressed." And in fact, I had the honor of visiting his tombstone. He's buried in Warsaw, in Poland. And on his tomb, big two words, Rav Chesed, which means the rabbi of, what's Chesed? Kindness. Which is interesting because when you think about the Soloveitchiks and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, what they're really known for is their scholarship and their erudition. They were like the great of the Lithuanian Talmud scholars. But the greatness really of Rav Chaim was not these stories, it's the fact that he behaved in this kind of way and is remembered as a person of chesed, despite the fact that he himself related to his grandson, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who I always quote, that he was not by nature a person of generous spirit, but it was something that did not come easy to him, but something he had to actually work on his entire life. And we are here to talk a little about this part of the Torah, to try to study the parts of Judaism that relate to us becoming more sensitive, more kind-hearted people. Now, it was always assumed that if you were learned, and if you were Torah-observant Jew, a more refined and ethical personality would emerge. And it's a good assumption. I just put my son, my number two, on a plane 2 days ago. He went to Israel for the year. He's going to study in a yeshiva. It's a very typical thing, the gap year. There were like hundreds of kids going off for their year. And you always wonder, how is he going to come back different? He's going to go for a year of Torah study. What's it going to be like? Will he talk to me again when he gets back? I'm just kidding. But it's always assumed that somebody who studies a lot of Torah and is very pious and religious is obviously a very refined and sensitive individual. After all, following God's word should in and of itself purify our personalities. I mean, what's in the Torah after all? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, it says in the Torah. Love thy neighbor as thyself. It tells us not to be jealous, not to hate. There's a Torah prohibition to harbor hate for your fellow Jew or to become angry. We're going to talk about anger a little. But we know that the two don't always go hand in hand. Just because a person is religious doesn't necessarily mean their character or their personality is on the highest level. I mean, we've all met an individual here and there who, you know, puts themselves out as a very religious, orthodox individual, but might come across as somewhat rude or discourteous. I don't want to just say rude in the Emily Post sense of the word rude. You go to Israel, and we just came back, and we would consider people really rude and discourteous, but that's just part of the culture. That's a little more etiquette over ethics. I'm talking about ethical behavior. Someone who observes Shabbat but pushes their way to the Kiddush to get to the cholent first at the refreshments, right? We've all encountered individuals we clearly label religious but who don't seem to possess proper midot. And we just kind of assume that if someone's observant, they must be this incredibly high-level, refined personality. But we know that we all struggle with anger issues. We are not as grateful as we should be. We become jealous. We get hungry for money and for material possessions. Even if we come to a Torah class and we study or we observe the Sabbath and we pray every day. But you ask yourself, is it really a crazy thing? I mean, we are still human. And, you know, to err is human and to be a human being is really human. On the other hand, we would kind of expect a little more. Right, a person who is holding himself out as a Torah observant Jew should expect more. And it should make us kinder and more generous with our money and with our time. And by the way, statistically it's true. Religious people do give more charity and do volunteer more time than people who are not. And that's across the spectrum, all religions. Statistically, the numbers are pretty clear. And it should be giving us an upper hand in dealing with our inner demons. Now, this is not a new issue. What I'm describing, this issue I'm dancing around, is not a new issue. in the mid-1800s. There was a young rabbi in Lithuania by the name of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He was from a town called Salant. A lot of the rabbis get nicknamed after their towns. And he saw that there were many people in his community who were maintaining a great faith commitment to Torah Judaism despite raging anti-Semitism and raging assimilation, but they were losing their emotional connection to Judaism's inner meaning. And he began to introduce what is called today, and I want to share some of this over the next few weeks with you, the Musar movement. Musar is an ethical teaching. Sometimes in the Orthodox world, if you say the word Musar, people get turned off because it implies a certain sort of judgmentalism. I'm going to give you Musar. You think you're such a holy roller. Really, you could be doing better. You shouldn't be doing this. You should be doing that. But it really means ethics. And Rabbi Yisrael Misalant began to introduce these ethical teachings into a curriculum. Because what's the curriculum in a typical yeshiva? My son is studying for the year in Israel. And my other son just came back from 2 years of Torah study. So what do you think they spend most of the day studying? Men and women, but probably more men. The women have a little of a broader curriculum, I would say, depending on the school and the orientation. What do you think, guys? They're studying Talmud. Now, what's Talmud? Talmud can make you a really good lawyer. Talmud's law, most of it's law. Now, thrown in through the Talmud is a lot of ethics and teachings, because studying Talmud is like listening in on a scholarly discourse between great sages. So they'll be in a conversation about, you know, how many judges do you need? I'm doing the Daf Yomi page of Talmud a day. I've been doing it for a while now. And what kind of panel of judges do you need to adjudicate a monetary dispute? Anybody know? Three. What about a dispute that could end up dealing with the person's body, like an assault or battery? You need at least 23. And then you have the Sanhedrin Gadol, the Beit Din HaGadol, the 71, that would deal with societal issues. And it goes back and forth, and all the rules of evidence and prosecutorial jurisprudence. And it's very technical. And then in the middle, there's this, like, all of a sudden, again, they go off on a tangent and start talking about ethics and personality development. So what Yisrael Misalant did was he started putting together the different parts strewn throughout the Talmudic literature, ethics of our fathers, parts of the Torah, five books of Moses, and the Nevi'im, and the prophets, and the writings. We started putting together works of Musar, so that a student could sit down for 45 minutes or an hour, open up a Musar book, and actually study Jewish ethics. Because before this, you'd have to kind of find it someplace. And now, Jews have always studied texts having to do with ethics and personality. But what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter did was to get these Torah sources woven into the very fabric of the yeshiva curriculum so that it would be systemized. Because that which is not systemized, I don't know, fill it in. It doesn't stick. It doesn't end up staying. Torah is supposed to refine our character. But in order for that to happen, we do have to study the parts of the Torah that help us deal with our demons and make us more sensitive and caring people. And if we don't, and we just focus on the legalities, then we run the risk of becoming technocrats, fulfilling the many dictates of the minutiae of the halacha, but missing a huge part of what Judaism is all about. There's a story actually told about Rabbi Yisrael Misalant. There's great stories about him. Famous one before Passover. He was approached by his disciples. And they asked him, they told him actually, that this year we are entrusted with baking the matzot for the community. You know, to bake the matzahs for the holiday. So the students wanted to know what specific halachot, what Jewish traditions, what laws should they most, you know, carefully pay attention to when baking the matzos for Passover. And Rabbi Salant answered famously. He said, when you come to bake the matzahs in this town, you will meet an elderly woman who every year brings in the water and the flour. This is how she earns her livelihood. The most important halacha in baking matzah in this community, he said, is to make sure that this woman does not have to carry the water and the flour too far. That's the most important halacha. Then he went in to other, you know, all the other nitty-gritties, how long do you let, you know, let it in, but pull it out before it ferments, and all the details of matzahs. But just as important as the actual matzah baking was the dignity and the respect that he was teaching his students that they needed to have for this woman. And that is a simple little thing, but it's something that so often gets overlooked. And what I'd like to do with you is share some other ideas. Rabbeinu Yonah, who was a great 12th century scholar and commentator on the Talmud, wrote that the Shechina, God's presence, can never rest on anyone who does not have good midos. What's a midah? Midah literally means a measure. But when we speak about someone who has good midos, somebody called me and wanted to know if I knew a young woman who was coming to MJE. His son started to date her. Just want to know, tell me a little about her midah. So what's a midah? Her character. It's a pretty broad question. But he wanted to know a little, what's her personality like? How does she spend her time? What's her demeanor like? And the Gaon of Vilna, one of the great genius of Vilna, wrote that the essential purpose of life is to work on improving our character traits. They said that when he was a small boy, he once went out to play with some other kids on a seesaw. He was an extraordinarily perfected individual at a very, very young age. And a few minutes later, he came back, and his father asked him why he returned so quickly, why he wasn't continuing to play with his friends, and he said he couldn't ride on the seesaw. And his father said, I don't understand why. He says, because in order for me to go up, my friend has to go down. This is what he said. And somehow he saw in this seesaw a possible violation of the mitzvah of loving your neighbor. Now, most of us are not born like this, and these are like crazy Rebbe stories that you hear. Most of them are true. But it's not easy. And I would contend that personality development, harder. Harder to do than studying the other parts of the Talmud that deal with all the legalities. Because if you have a good head, you spend enough time on it, and you figure out which way is up, and what Abaye and Rava are arguing over in the Talmud, you figure out what the halach is, and hopefully you keep to it. Good. But overcoming like a drive that we have, Rav Yisrael Misalan said it's easier to master 100 pages of Talmud than it is to change one midah in your personality. But we believe it's doable. And I'm going to discuss this a little more next week. Next week I'm going to devote our discussion to free will. How do we really know that you can change your personality? There are some who argue against the concept of free will. Judaism very much believes in free will. If we didn't, we wouldn't have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You know, it would be like an exercise in futility. Why would God be upset with us if we're just playing out our predetermined, you know, parts? But it's so fundamental to grow and to develop. If you remember Abraham, our forefather, patriarch, founder of Judaism, who was living in Israel, and it was time for him to find a mate for his beloved son Isaac, where did he send his trusted servant Eliezer, the shadchan, the matchmaker? He sent him out to go find a suitable spouse for his son Isaac. Where does he send him? So he tells him that he should not bring home a woman from Canaan. Now he lived in Canaan. Canaan was the biblical term for Israel, for ancient Israel. And he told him to go elsewhere. Told him to go to Padam Aram. Now Padam Aram was hundreds of miles away. And it's interesting because in those days, everybody was involved in idol worship. So why did Abraham insist that Eliezer travel with a caravan for over 500 miles in the hot desert, not to find a girl for his son in Canaan, but to go to Padam Aram? And the sages explain that the people in Canaan may have had good deot, knowledge, but they were lacking in midot, tovot, in good personality traits and character. While the people in Padam Aram may have been lacking in knowledge, but they possessed finer midot. And what happened when Eliezer finally got to Padam Aram? Where did he meet the girl he would bring home for his trusted master, for Yitzchak? Where? At a well. And what was the criteria that Eliezer came up with? He came to the well and he said to himself, little bubble went off in front of him. What did he say? How was he going to figure out all these beautiful women there? And maybe there's somebody here for Yitzchak. And he said to himself that anyone who would not only offer me, a complete stranger, some water from the well — by the way, it's not so simple. It's not like you just fill up a cup from the water cooler. A well, you got to take the bucket and pull it down and pull it up. And it's hot and people are waiting online. Not only someone who offers me some water, but all my camels. That's a tall order. And of course, that was Rebecca. So you see the criteria. And it's the same thing. I asked one of the great rabbis at Yeshiva University, Rav Herschel Schachter, I remember years ago. I was in his classroom and the students were asking, when I was single, what should we look for? What's the most important thing to look for? And he always focused about midos. And it remains to this day a key ingredient in what we try to look for in a potential spouse. So, very, very important. Question is, how? And what do we do? So, and what is the goal in trying to develop our midot? And we'll get into one or two sources tonight. The first thing, though, most important thing, to keep this real, what's the goal? Goal is to become better. Goal is not to become perfect. That doesn't exist. The goal is not to be angels or saints. The goal is to develop our personalities so we improve. Now, the more we improve, the better, obviously. But, you know, the Talmud says, "Tafasta meruva lo tafasta." You try to grab onto too much, you end up with nothing. The Torah is very realistic. And I would even argue that becoming this picture-perfect person, where nothing bothers you, you always say the right thing at the right time, it's not realistic. And it's not even the goal. Take a look on your source sheet under the first source. Rambam, the great Maimonides, wrote a whole treatise on character development called Hilchot Deot. If anybody in the back needs, we've got a few more. You want to just pass those to our friends in the back? Before I read on, any questions or comments?
I didn't really...
Yeah.
Never ending.
It never ends. This is not something
there's
you
no
do.
Goals.
Well, there are goals. And you'll see from the Rambam outlines some goals, the great Maimonides. We're going to read it in a minute. There are goals. But in terms of the first thing you said, it doesn't really end. This is never, we're always.
There's no satisfaction.
Well, there is a satisfaction.
There's no.
There's a satisfaction, I feel like, if you've improved somewhat.
But then satisfaction with where you have come, rather than thinking it has to continue.
Well, look, you go to the gym and you want to eventually be able to bench, I don't know, 250, five reps, 5 rounds, 8 to 10 reps each. So that's not going to happen. You'll kill yourself if you. So you start 100 pounds. It's going to take a while. 100 pounds. And then the next time you go at 105, you have to build it up. It's no different with our personalities.
So it just feels like you can't stop and breathe and say, I'm so happy, I'm happy.
Well, that's why everybody's goal has to be a little different. And I think it's like the gym. If you know something is so simple and nothing, you're not going to feel any sense of satisfaction. Hey, you knew you could do that. That wasn't you got to tear a little cartilage in order to build muscle. So if you're not feeling like a little pain, then you're not going to have a sense of satisfaction. If you take on too much, you'll probably be out of the gym. So it's a balance, really. It's a balance. But it's like anything else in life. You want to chart a plan, and that's really what Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is all about. It's not just showing up in synagogue and saying, I'm sorry, I'll do better. It's being really specific. How do I want to get better? And really, what are my goals? And make the goals realistic so that you can actually feel good about achieving them, and then you'll want to continue more. Most of us give up after a certain amount of time because we put the goalposts over here, we don't get to it, and we give up. Move the goalposts a little back. It won't be as spectacular, but then you can revel in accomplishing A, and then you can move on to B.
Well, let's get a little more specific. Follow with me in the Rambam. Aderecha Yishara Himida Benonis. This is very important. Maimonides considered himself a student of Aristotle. Now, he didn't live around the same time, but he studied Greek philosophy. And if anyone ever studied Aristotelian philosophy, the famous golden mean, where the goal is not, the goal is the middle of the road. And the Rambam believed that that was the Jewish approach. Look what he writes. Aderech Yishara, the straight path, Himida Benonit, is the midpoint. Shebechol Deavadeh. He's talking about character development, temperament. What is the goal? Never to get angry about anything, ever? No, that's not a good thing. Because if you never get angry, ever, about anything, then what? Is that bad? Why is that bad? Right, it sounds like you're apathetic or you're indifferent. You also can't model behavior. You can't parent or teach anyone what's right or wrong, what you think is right or wrong. If you don't get upset, oh, everything, it's okay, I'm fine. No. Now, if you get upset about 2 minutes, so how do you know what's upset, what's worthy of being upset, what's not? That's what the Torah is for. But the Rambam, and that's why anger is a really good example to use. Follow with me. Then, so it involves discovering the midpoint temperament of each and every trait that man possesses within his personality. That refers to the trait which is equidistant from either of the extremes, without being close to either of them. Therefore, the early sages instructed a person to evaluate his traits. I'm sorry, it's broken off here. I always try to break something off in all my classes. To emulate them and to direct them along the middle path, so he should be sound of body. For example, he should not be wrathful, easily angered, nor be like a dead person without feeling. Now, the opposite of being, you know, everything ticks you off. You fly off the handle of nothing, you know. What's the opposite of that? Nothing upsets you. That means you have no spine, you have no backbone, you have no morals, you stand for nothing. Something should upset you, and you should get upset
in a reasonable way, right? You should try to compose yourself, but anger is actually an important thing. By the way, you know, this is a distinction, I think, between Judaism and Christianity. As we grow up in a Christian country, and we think the holier the person, the more they just blow off. Turn the other cheek, forgive everybody, forgive everything. It's not really the Jewish approach. We don't bear grudges either. So there's something in the middle where you learn to communicate what you feel is inappropriate, what is wrong, what you believe is wrong. You communicate that. And you don't have to, by the way, we're going to talk about this also, about forgiving, as we get closer to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. You don't have to forgive everybody for everything if they're not repentant. Right? That's a very Christian concept. If you turn the other cheek, that relates to original sin. If any of you saw the video I sent out, Failing Forward, if any of you watched that. So I talk a little about the difference between Jewish and Christian theology. The reason turn the other cheek in Christianity is because we're born sinners in Catholic dogma. So you have to be forgiving of other people because that's just the way God made you. In Judaism, we have a different concept of original sin. I don't want to get into that right now. And because of our differing concept, we hold people responsible. That doesn't mean we're not forgiving and we don't try to let things go. But if the person hasn't really changed their behavior and they make it clear they're not going to, you have no responsibility to forgive them. You can hold the other person accountable for their actions. But you also shouldn't be an action, which is like Yiddish for stubborn, or nachzari, which is Hebrew for cruel. and just never letting it go, when someone really is sorry and they feel bad and they want to change, and you're not going to let them do that. You're going to just keep them in that place. That's wrong too, because they really want to change. So there's this middle road. It's complicated. Let's continue along. He gives examples here. So he talks about anger. He says he should display anger only when the matter is serious enough to warrant it, in order to prevent the matter from reoccurring. And this is very interesting, because the Rambam has a whole discussion about anger. And maybe I'll come back to this. We have some time. I'll come back to this in a few minutes. But the question is, how do you do this? So he says, Ketzad lo yabal chema noach lechos. A person shouldn't be someone who gets easily angered, but he shouldn't be kemes. He shouldn't be like a dead person who doesn't feel anything. But he should be in the middle. What does that mean, to be in the middle when it comes to anger? Get angry, but only on things that are worthy of getting angry. And then he gives another example. What about desire for physical things? Right? You should lust after physical things to the extent that the body requires them, but within reason. Or when it comes to earning a livelihood and making money, a person should earn and should work hard, but what they need. You have to constantly work, and there's no time for anything else. Or giving away money, he says. You know, should you give everything away? Is that a good Jew? Give it all away. Leave this world penniless. No. That's not... The Talmud says you should try to give 10% of your annual earnings, and not more than 20%. Why? So if you give... So you don't end up on the other side, on the receiving end, because you gave away too much. Now, if you're Bill Gates, or Michael Bloomberg, you can join the... They have a club now. I daven to be in that club. It hasn't happened yet. The club where you know the club? It's a pretty cool club. They give away half of their... They've committed to giving half away of their fortunes, because they don't need $5 billion to live. Okay? And they have, whatever, that kind of money. So if you're in a certain situation, you can give more than 20%. But generally speaking, giving away too much is not good for you either. But not giving enough away is being stingy. So the Torah has a whole kind of recipe. What about being laughter here? He says, "Veloya meholel v'sochek." Person shouldn't always be walking around laughing all the time. Well, what's wrong with that? Is it good to be happy? Is that what he's talking about? No. He's talking about like being frivolous. Like everything is a joke. Right? We all have a friend or two like that. But what's the opposite? What's the opposite? He says, but don't be an atzev onen. Atzev is sad, or onen, like you're in mourning. Like, oi. So what should you do? Shouldn't like, hey, you know, like the fake party face we put on when we go to like a party? Right? Or the opposite is like... So the ethics of the fathers teaches what? That we should be makabel kol adam b'sever panim yafot. We should greet other people with a positive countenance. Have you ever seen Rav Nevensol? Those of you who came to Israel with us, we bumped into him twice. He's always smiling. But he's not over-elated. He's not like, hey, what's going on? He's just seems to be expressing a certain level of inner happiness. But it's not over the top. And I realize that this is gray. Because for everyone, this is like a little different. And you need to tweak it. And for everyone here, certain things are going to come easier than others. Like my father-in-law, Zichron Levracha, you should rest in peace. He was one of the most even-keeled men I'd ever met in my life. I just like very few things, like ticked him off or just made him upset. Traffic, that was like it. He went nuts when he was in traffic. He was like not pleasant to be around when he was in traffic. I never saw him angered or upset other than like traffic, like bad traffic. It's really in... So for him, that wasn't so difficult. But he had other things. Other people are easily angered, and that's a very, very difficult thing. So what is the Rambam saying? How do we do this, though? I want you to come out of tonight's class with something practical. What should we do to model this middle-of-the-road behavior? I mean, you can think to yourself right now, just take a moment, what is it that I would really like to improve in my own personality? Do I get too easily angered, or am I too indifferent? Am I a little stingy with my money? Am I overly generous? I don't meet a lot of people like that. Am I, you know, doing too much? Whatever it is. Am I walking around happy all the too happy, or am I like too downtrodden? So the Rambam, take a look at source number 2. The Kate said, Yargil Adam Atzmo B'deot Elu. How should a person accustom themselves in these character traits? Ad Shikvubo, so that they become fixed. See, the goal is not to do them casually. The goal is eventually to have these things part and parcel of our personality, so we don't even have to think about them. They actually become natural and organic to who we are. How do you do that? Even before I read on, anybody, psychologists in the room, any behavioralists in the room, what would you say? What's that? How would you do this? How do you develop a more middle-of-the-road temperament in your personality when it comes to all these different traits?
There could be many methods.
Of course, there are many. One, if you'd like to share one. What do you think? Give me a suggestion. What would you say? Yeah?
Meditation.
Meditation. Be more specific. Meditate over a desired... to control an impulse. Meditation is actually a very, very effective method. Needs to be done somewhat consistently also. Believe it or not, that's what prayer is supposed to be. That's why we pray so much. Prayer is supposed to be a time when we actually meditate and focus over impulses, traits, issues we're having, thoughts we're thinking, feelings we're experiencing. And we do believe that you can control these things. Okay? It can take years, especially if it's a really tough drive and impulse that you have. Yeah?
You know, with the Lashon Ra, at least, like, after it cut, stubbing your tongue or something, physical strategies to get yourself to not say things when you have that impulse.
So let's say you're trying to curb your slanderous talk. You're bad-mouthing people. So there might be reminders. You could have a little reminder because and these are sort of behavioral tactics to do this. The Rambam suggests, as you'll see in the next line, just do it. In other words, whatever the desired behavior, start practicing it as often as possible. And the sheer repetition of the behavior can alter it on a consistent basis. Follow with me a little. The Ketzed Yargil Atzmo B'deit Elu Atshikvubo Yaseh, do it, V'yishana, do it again, V'yishalesh, and do it a third time. B'masim She'oseh, that the things that you want to do, Al Piyadeot HaMtziot, these middle-of-the-road activities, if you will. V'yachzor Bahem Tamid, and keep reviewing, keep going over, Ad Shiyu Ma'asem Kalim Alav. This is very not sort of the Freudian psychoanalytic, trying to understand why am I doing this? What leads me to speak ill of my neighbor? Now, I'm not saying not to try that. In a sense, that's a more comprehensive way of change, is to really get to the root of it and understand what is it. You know what? I only seem to badmouth people around those people. Maybe it's because I'm trying to, sort of get in with them. I feel a little insecure about them, and a quick fix is to say something negative about someone else. So if that's it, then maybe I need to work on my own insecurities, or maybe I should stop hanging out with them. But the Rambam is saying something simpler. Rather than lying down on someone's couch and trying to decipher the very root cause, just attack behaviorally. Just start doing the desired behavior. Or, and this is harder, begin to stop the negative behavior. Now, I don't necessarily, I'm not saying this works for every person and every problem. There is the reason there's a whole world of psychoanalytic and post-Freudian psychoanalytic analysis is because sometimes you need to go deeper. And sometimes sort of the B.F. Skinner behavioral approach doesn't work for everything. But the truth is, B modification has been proven to be very, very successful with all sorts of types of neurosis and even psychosis. People who haven't communicated with other people who have been able to be conditioned in fairly normal ways. There are studies I've seen of people who could never eat with utensils, with a fork and a knife, who can't take of their own care of their own hygiene because of certain serious psychological issues, and have been able to change through behavior modification. It's really an amazing thing. As I said, it doesn't work for everything, but it does work for a lot of things. Any other suggestions? Any other things if anybody wants to share that you've ever tried? If there's an undesirable behavior that you want to begin to uproot from your personality. Yeah?
So there's this bad diet called Whole 30. The 30 days you cut out meat, sugar, dairy, alcohol.
Right.
And after doing that, you should be able to be strong enough to cut it out of your life.
To cut what out? Alcohol?
Alcohol, sugar, dairy, wheat.
Just by cutting it out for 30 days.
30 days, be strict, and then give yourself limits.
It's called turkey, basically.
Cold turkey.
Cold turkey
for 30 days, and then you come out better than you were 30 days before you did that.
Okay.
Right. So basically what...
Yeah, I mean that's basically what he's saying. It's just do it, basically.
Right.
That's what it is. It's just doing it. And
also not expecting to succeed on the first try. You have to be able to accept failure.
Expect failure.
Or accept.
Accept it.
In Israel, they have, in the Sems, the girls walk to the kotel, or go to the kotel 40 days in a row. Because if you go to the kotel 40 days in a row, and you're dealing with a particular issue, whatever
right.
the case may be, then after a while, it's ingrained in
the system. Helps. Right. It helps. 100%. So that's so actually, what I want to do is, the Rambam goes to town having to do with anger. And I thought I would just spend the last couple of minutes we have tonight on that, and maybe using that as an example. Because I think we all suffer from anger on some level, even those amongst us who might be a little easier going temperaments. The Rambam, if you look at the source sheet that I gave out, you turn the page on where it says dealing with anger. He says, "V'chein akas mida ra'ah hi ad ma'od." And I'm sharing this also because, you know, to every rule is an exception. And the Rambam actually makes an exception to his middle of the road. Everything is middle of the road except if you've got the anger bug. Then the Rambam says, you go to the other extreme. Anger is so detrimental, he writes. Mida ra'ah. Excuse me, he adlam odid is such an evil trait. The ra'ula adam shidrachek mimena ad hakatzah acher. He says it is worthy for a person to distance himself to the opposite extreme. Right now, we just said before, it's not good to go to the opposite extreme when it comes to anger. What's that? That's indifference. That's being dead. But he says if the only way for you to get rid of that anger is to be a little dead, then be dead. You know what I mean when I say be dead. Right? Just go to the opposite. Teach yourself never to get angry. Now we'll talk about this. Even on things that is worthy of getting angry. This is very interesting. It says, let's say you need to instill fear in your children. Now what does that mean, you need to instill fear? You need to discipline your kids. They can't walk all over you. I'm not one to talk about this. But, al tzibor imaya parnas. So you're like the head of the community and you need to try to direct people. You want to get angry so that they'll do the right thing. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that a rabbi whose community never gets upset at him is not being a rabbi. That means he's not giving musa. That means all he's doing is winning their popularity but not really helping them grow. So, what does he say? He says, anger is so... He says, Yar'atzmo bifneim shu koes. You should appear before them as though you're getting angry. Kedeli asrim, in order to teach them. V'tiyed datom yushevet lebein o lebein atzmo. But internally, you should never experience anger. He says, anger is so... dangerous, emotionally, internally, that you should never experience anger. But you should display it for educational purposes. Ka'adam shumedame koes, like a person who makes believe that they're angry, bishas kaso, at the moment that he's angry, but internally he's really not. That's tough. You're not supposed to really feel that, but you need to demonstrate it, or else how do you impress upon your children not to run out in the middle of the street? If you say, oh, that's so sweet and beautiful, they'll do it again. And if, as an educator, right, if you don't show a little emotion that you're upset about something, then your students are not going to be able to learn properly. Now, why is it so bad that the Rambam would advocate going to the opposite extreme and not even to feel it internally, even though externally you need to educate? So, it's pretty simple. It's just so dangerous because anger causes tremendous strife and conflict. It's the main trait which can and has led to actual murder, and sometimes over the most trivial of things. It's the story of a guy who killed his neighbor over a dispute over a garbage can. It's a true story. A farmer who killed his neighbor for planting the same crop that he planted. A grocery store owner who killed his neighbor. A restaurant owner for selling the same kind of rolls. People literally become other people. And if we don't have to go to that extreme, I mean, I'm giving you crazy extreme situations, but I'm sure we all here remember something really stupid we said or did because we were angry. Now, what is the actual purpose of anger? Why do we get angry? Because something physiological happens when we get angry. What happens when you get angry? You start going crazy. You feel it. You feel like your blood is rushing. Right? Now, the purpose of anger is to... You ever heard of flight? Fight or flight? What is it? Fight or flight. And you get angry, like human beings, animals are... get angry in order to protect themselves when we're in physical danger. Therefore, the blood flows to where it's most needed to defend ourselves. The body produces more adrenaline so we can fight better, or flight, or run away. And at the same time, when we get angry, less blood flows to the brains because it's going elsewhere. And as a result, our brain receives less oxygen. We don't think as clearly. We say dumb things. We say things we don't really mean. Or we mean at the time, but, you know, our minds are elsewhere. In fact, look at the next source. Really interesting. Source number 6 on the bottom of page 2 from the Talmud. Bishlosha dvarim adam nikar. 3 ways you can tell a person's true character. It's a very famous Gemara. Bekoso, bekiso, bekaso. It's got a little cuff going on. Right, bekoso means with his cup, referring to wine or alcohol, right? Talmud elsewhere says, Nichnas yayin yotzei sod, put a little wine in, out comes a secret. Want to find out what a person's really thinking about you? Get a little drunk. So, koso, cup, kiso with his wallet, right? Money, you see a person's true, real stripes, and kaso, and with his anger. You know, and what's the common denominator? And Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great sages of the Talmud, explains, in all of these 3 cases, the power of the intellect is diminished. And at some level, inoperative. And our animal instincts begin to surface. And that explains why the Rambam, I skipped over this, right above there on the same page, writes, quotes from the Gemara, from the Talmud, that someone who gets angry, it's as though they're worshipping idols. I never understood that. I mean, getting angry is bad, but what does that have to do with worshipping idols? So the quote from the Talmud.
is you're literally worshiping a foreign god. You become somebody else. You literally, right? You're just not the same person, and you now are subscribing to some other kind of system. Rashi, the great biblical commentator, tells us that when the plague of frogs hit the Egyptians, remember the 10 plagues, when the frogs, my favorite plague, frogs here, frogs there, frogs, you know, whatever. So there are frogs everywhere. So there's a very famous midrash that says, how did the frogs appear? There was this huge one frog, and when the Egyptians saw the frog, they hit it, and it multiplied into two. And they hit the two frogs, and it turned into four, and four into eight. Every time they hit the frog, it kept doubling. So the great rabbinic sage, the Steigler, asked, I mean, the Egyptians were very smart. They built the pyramids. If every time they hit the frog, they saw it multiply, why didn't they stop hitting the frogs? They couldn't. They were angry. And when you're angry, you don't really have full control. Anger is an expression of the loss of control. And Rambam, Maimonides, elsewhere writes that that's what caused Moses himself to hit the rock instead of speaking to it like God had commanded him. The cause of him not being able to enter the land of Israel. So what's the solution? So we talked about a couple of behavioral modifications. What do you do? What's the simplest thing to do when you get angry? What's that?
Smile.
You could do that. Even before a smile, because that's like going to the opposite extreme. What does everyone say to do when you get angry?
Count to ten.
Backwards. Now, what does counting to ten do?
You take a minute.
You take breaths. You're actually allowing more oxygen to flow to the brain. Because it's not just taking ten; it's breathing. The oxygen calms our muscles and allows the oxygen to reach our thinking centers. And by the way, it's not just when you're angry like one-on-one. Like, you can get angry today virtually. You could open up a Facebook page and see something that really ticks you off. Or get an email and you're like, now what do you do when you get that email?
Respond.
Don't press send. You can write it, but don't press send. The writing can actually be helpful. It's therapeutic. Yeah,
also,
totally.
Like, just scream instead of counting.
Right, but I'll tell you something. Send, I've done this a few times, and I learned this the hard way. Because I'll send an email to a colleague, one of the other rabbis here. I'm like, I'm about to send this. And I always get like, wait a day. Just wait, take a day. I always feel differently a day later, or even a half a day later, even a couple hours later. I'm not saying you change your tune completely, but the emotional, irrational kind of response, because that actually just creates a worse of a situation. The Meiri, one of the great commentators in the Talmud, related that the rulers of Arabia testified that one of their earlier kings was a very good ruler, very honest and God-fearing person, someone who struggled with anger, gave a certain note with three sentences on it and instructed his servant to show him the note every time he got angry. If you want to see it, I put it here for you on page 3 on top. This is actually very progressive, even though this is from the early days, from many, many centuries ago. But Menachem Meiri, from on this Arabian king's note, quote, remember that you are created and not the creator. You are flesh and blood, and in the future you will rot and decay. I love that one. Remember that you will not be loved tomorrow if you do not love today. It's very powerful. The humility thing is important. Because we get angry, why? Because we feel we're entitled to something. And if you're humble, you don't necessarily believe you are necessarily entitled to that. So you change your whole tune. The other suggestion I have is to take into consideration the whole person. It says in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that Yehoshua ben Prachya and Itai of our Bailey received this tradition to provide yourself a teacher, win for yourself a companion, judge every man in a favorable light. Now what does that mean? Give people the benefit of the doubt. All right, easier said than done. The key to giving people the benefit of the doubt is actually in there. because you need to know the Hebrew. It says, "Havidan et kol ha'adam lekav zchut." Give all people the benefit of the doubt. Judge them meritoriously. So, the simple interpretation of that phrase is, judge all. Why does it say judge all? Of course all. No, not just your buddies, not just your cousin or your sibling. Judge all people meritoriously. Or, you can read it, judge all the person. When you're upset and you're looking at somebody, look at the whole person. Because you get upset because you're focused on the thing they just said that ticked you off, or what they did that was wrong. But if you can pull the lens back a little and look at the total person, that's not going to take away completely the anger, but it'll allow you to look at what you're upset about in the context of the entire person. And that helps give the benefit of the doubt. Number three, perspective, perspective, and perspective. You know, when you get angry, there's always that person there to kind of figuratively slap you. Dude, get a little perspective. Like, take into account how this fits into the larger scheme of things. Somebody I was around today was so angry, so upset because, and I felt bad for her. She clearly was having one of those, like, customer service, like, explosions. You know, an hour and a half on the phone. And I had this, you know, I called my good friend Dave yesterday because my computer, I went on it to do all my work, and I had a big question mark flashing on my laptop. And I text Dave, and I could tell from your tone, it's like, this is not good. So I drove to the closest, and I was in Long Island, I drove to like the closest like Apple place.
Roosevelt Field?
Yeah. Traffic, and I'm like, I'm on, and I found out, I'm going to use the time here to, you know, to get one of those technicians on the phone. And he was like pretty good, you know. And I was doing it, I shouldn't have been doing it like when I was driving, whatever it is. And I'm like going, and like I was on the phone for the guy for 45 minutes, and just like nothing, you know? And it's just a great, so like, it's perspective. You know what? I blew 5 hours yesterday on this. Wow. I did. 5 hours, a lot of time. But it's perspective, dude. You know what I mean? It's like now, while I was in it, I'm a big shot right now. I can talk about it. It's a day later and I got it fixed, thank God. But that's what happens. And if you can pull it back, that's why brachot are very important. Saying blessings. Little brachot over something you eat. Make a bracha before you eat something. It puts it all into perspective. I didn't have to have that fruit. Thank you for giving me the fruit. It's such a simple little thing, but it's like I'm verbalizing my gratitude for something that I'm just expecting to have. But why? Why am I expecting? You know, 2/3 of the world don't have fruit like this. We don't have anything like we have. We live in such affluence and we totally mull over it. And it ceases to make us happy because we're not grateful for it. So that's a kind of like, you know, a broader kind of look at it. The other thing is very important, the next bullet, and I'll finish up in a moment, is get it off your chest. You're angry, you can't bottle it up. It's really unhealthy. And I find as a rabbi that people often bottle things up when they should be expressing it, and sometimes we should keep our mouth shut when we do express it. But if you're upset with someone, I'm not saying to approach them right then and right there. Let things calm down. But don't just imagine I'm just going to go away. And none of us likes to have that conversation because, you know, we don't want to be confrontational. But it has a way of eating at us. And that's why the Torah says explicitly, Lo tisna tachicha bilvavecha. Look at the next verse in the middle of the page. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Hochech tochich et amitecha. Reprove your fellow. And don't bear sin. Now Nachmanides asks, a great commentator on Kabbalah, what's sin? Don't harbor hate. Reprove your neighbor. You see your neighbor doing something wrong, say something. And don't bear sin. What's sin? So Nachmanides says, it's the sin of harboring hate. What does harboring hate have to do with getting it off your chest? So Nachmanides says, you're going to end up harboring hate if you don't get it off your chest. If you don't say something, you're going to end up developing ill will. Now, you need to know when to talk and when not to talk. Sometimes you just need to let it go and not bring it up, because your friend may simply not be able to handle it, no matter how well you finesse your language. But if you feel somewhat confident that you can share this with the other person, it can actually bring you closer if done properly. And even if it doesn't bring you closer, it at least stops the ill will from building. Because we don't forget as easily as we would like to. And therefore the Torah wants us to share and to get off our chests. I want to end with a story. Actually, just two quick stories and I'll close. And you all heard maybe of the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote a famous book on... Why are you laughing?
Because I just bought his books today.
Oh, there you go. So the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote a number of famous books, but one was on slander. And he seemed to be one of these rabbis that like never got upset. And there's a story that one of his students one night hid under a bench in a synagogue and saw the Chafetz Chaim coming into his own shul late at night, opening up the Holy Ark and imploring God to help him conquer his anger.
Wow.
Which is a demonstration that this was not something that came easy to him. And we often think when other people are, you know, that, oh, it must be simple. No, it's not. Just because someone's a big rabbi doesn't mean they don't have a temper. Rav Nachman of Breslov, the great Hasidic master, he was the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, related that by nature he was an angry person, which is so difficult to understand because you know about the Breslov or Hasidim, they're the guys walking around smiling and happy all the time. And he was by nature not a happy person. He worked his whole life on this. And my favorite, most inspirational figure is sort of in the secular world, is someone who actually ran for the presidency and didn't make it. He wrote this in his book, Dr. Ben Carson, who was arguably maybe the most boring candidate for office, but the highest level character, I think, of anyone probably on both sides, in my opinion. I can say anything I want, it's over now. But... you know, he's an incredibly inspirational figure coming out of a really difficult life of poverty and becoming one of the world's leading neurosurgeons and had a very serious anger issue. I read this in his book, and also in Jonathan Sacks wrote a book called Healing a Fractured World, where he writes about Dr. Ben Carson. He lunged at the age of 14 at his best friend with a camping knife, got into some stupid fight, and almost killed the kid, and he realized at that age that anger and rage was literally, you know, going to ruin his life. I'm not suggesting you do what he did, but this is what he writes he did. He locked himself for hours in a bathroom reading the Bible. You shouldn't bring a Bible to the bathroom, but he did. I guess it was good. And, you know, he was looking for some wisdom, you know, and... when he left the bathroom, he said he made a decision that he would make getting over his anger a priority. And he finished up high school with honors, got a full scholarship to Yale in 1965, and it changed everything. It changed everything. And he went from someone that really had a very difficult background and had a lot of inner demons that he talks about. And he seems like the most calm. You know, I fall asleep listening to him. He's so calm. But... he is considered one of the leading neurosurgeons in the world. In 1987, he made medical history by being the first surgeon to successfully separate twins, co-joined at the back of their head, and he led a 50-member surgical team. They worked for 22 hours. He got the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Bush. I mean, it's just an unbelievable expression of how a person can change and make something extraordinary out of themselves by working on themselves and by conquering their inner demons. And again, there's different ways of doing it. The Rambam suggests repetition, behavior modification, desired behavior, just keep doing it again and again. There were some other suggestions here. We talked about anger and counting to 10 and getting a little rational about things and not sending that email so quickly. But the point is really the same, to figure out something specific that works and giving ourselves bite-sized goals so that we actually can achieve, feel good about it, and move on to the next goal. And that is something to think about, obviously, as we now start the month of Elul and continue on. I'll end with a famous quote from another great Hasidic master, Menachem Mendel of Kutz, who once said, people, he said, are accustomed to look at the heavens and wonder what happens, that what happened there, that it would be better. That it would be better if things, you know, if I was up in heaven and everything was perfect over there. And he said, really, the goal of this life is to look inside here, to look within ourselves to see what's going on here, and to take a good, honest look at it and ask ourselves what we can do about it. And we'll continue with this point next week, Judaism's belief that we can actually change. I'm going to talk a little about free will and some of the studies that seem to indicate otherwise, and why the Rambam and others believe so much in our capacity to change. That's what the whole high holiday season is about. That's what we're here to discuss. So I thank you guys for sharing. Any other comments or questions before we close up? Yes, Dave.
I apologize if I sounded terse in my text.
You are not terse at all. You gave it to me straight.
First day back from Israel, and I had a pile of tickets. I was already on number 10 by lunch.
Oh, God.
So, text was the only way I could keep my composure of the show.
Parking tickets.
No, job tickets. We have a help desk system, and they assigned me probably 40 tickets while I was out on vacation.
Oh, my God.
I was at lunch eating salad because I had overeaten.
You went out, so that was pretty good for what you were experiencing.
Thank you.
Thanks for getting back. All right, we'll see you guys next week. This Shabbat, by the way, is an awesome Shabbos at MJ. And he's thinking about the Jewish court system, because it's Parshat Shoftim. If anyone's around, you want to join us. Have a great night, everyone. We can continue same time, same place next week. Thank you, Duva, for doing this.
Pleasure to have everyone.